This episode of Navarra Live is brought to you by listeners like you. Thank you.
Welcome to Navarra Live. It's a Friday night. I'm Michael Walker and I'm joined by Aaron Bastani. Aaron, how are you doing?
Very good, Michael. Just rubbing in the last of my moisturizer. Ready to go. Groomed and full of energy for a great show.
I was going to say it's important to keep moisturising at your age, but it's actually important to keep moisturising at my age, and I don't. And my partner sort of does it every night, and I still haven't used any moisturiser. I'm getting these kind of wrinkles here. A lot of important stories for you tonight, but it has just broken that the Princess of Wales is receiving treatment for cancer. We won't be leading with that story, but we will be speaking to our royal correspondent, Ash Sarkar, in 15 minutes or so. Presumably that will put an end to a lot of the speculation which we have witnessed over the past few months. Do stay tuned for that. Lots of other incredibly important topics this evening. Developments at the UN, the conflict in Sudan, and then sort of on a lighter note, the British freak out about the England flag on the England football team. Straight on to our first story. Before today, three resolutions had gone to the UN Security Council calling for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. In each of those cases, the United States had been the lone veto. However, today it was the United States that put forward a ceasefire motion to the Security Council, and this time it was vetoed by Russia and China. This was the response from the US ambassador to the UN.
Russia and China will give you all sorts of explanations for its obstruction. But whether or not it will admit it, there are two deeply, deeply cynical reasons behind its votes. First, Russia and China still could not bring itself to condemn Hamas's terrorist attacks on October 7th. Can we just pause on that for a moment? Russia and China refuses to condemn Hamas for burning people alive, for gunning down innocent civilians at a concert, for raping women and girls, for taking hundreds of people hostage. This was the deadliest single attack on Jews since the Holocaust. And a permanent member of this council can't even condemn it. I'm sorry, it's really outrageous, and it's below the dignity of this body. The second reason behind this veto is not just cynical, it's also petty. Russia and China simply did not want to vote for a resolution that was penned by the United States because it would rather see us fail than to see this council succeed.
So is that really what happened? Did Russia and China have a chance to support an immediate ceasefire in Gaza but refused to do so because, first, it would mean condemning Hamas and they didn't want to do that, and second, simply because it was written by the United States? Let's look at the actual ceasefire clause in the resolution put forward by the US. So it's a long proposal, but this is the relevant clause when it comes to a ceasefire. The United Nations Security Council determines the imperative of an immediate and sustained ceasefire to protect civilians on all sides, allow for the delivery of essential humanitarian assistance, and alleviate humanitarian suffering. And towards that end, unequivocally supports ongoing international diplomatic efforts to secure such a ceasefire in connection with the release of all remaining hostages. Now, if you read that carefully, it's not actually demanding a ceasefire at all. Instead, it says a ceasefire is necessary, it's imperative, and then to that end, it supports the same diplomatic process which has until now failed. Right? So it's just supporting a process, saying a ceasefire would be nice. And that process, which has been ongoing for a while now, has failed for a reason. Israel wants Hamas to give up all their hostages in exchange for a temporary ceasefire, after which Israel can restart its bombardment of Gaza in an effort to completely destroy Hamas. Now, Hamas, as you can imagine, only wants to give up its hostages in exchange for something more durable. The idea of giving up all of their leverage only to then get completely destroyed in 6 weeks' time isn't attractive to them. So this motion to the UN put forward by the United States wouldn't really have counted for much. And that was the argument made by Russia in the debate before the Security Council vote.
To save the lives of peaceful Palestinian civilians, this is not enough. And this is in no way what is stipulated in the mandate of the UN Security Council, the council which is vested with a unique mechanism to demand a ceasefire and, where necessary, to compel compliance therewith.
And speaking after the Security Council vote, the Chinese representative made a similar point.
The final text remains ambiguous and does not call for an immediate ceasefire, nor does it even provide an answer to the question of realizing a ceasefire in the short term. This is a clear deviation from the consensus of the Council members and fell far short of the expectations of the international community. An immediate ceasefire is a fundamental prerequisite for saving lives, expanding humanitarian access, and preventing greater conflicts. The U.S. draft, on the contrary, sets up preconditions for a ceasefire, which is no different from giving a green light to continued killings, which is unacceptable.
So those were the two countries that vetoed the resolution. There was also a non-permanent member of the Security Council that voted against the United States. And it was the only Arab state present. So this was Algeria's ambassador to the UN.
It is beyond any doubt that Resolution 2712 and 2720 have fallen short due to the absence of a clear demand for a ceasefire. Those who believe that the Israeli occupying power will choose to uphold its international legal obligation are mistaken.
So just as a reminder as to how the UN Security Council works, there's five permanent members, so Britain, France, the United States, Russia, and China, and then there are 10 rotating members, so sort of all the other countries get a chance to be on the Security Council for a short period of time. It's only those permanent members that get a veto. And Algeria, you know, as you can see there, are one of the 10 who are a non-permanent member of the Security Council at the moment. Aaron, what do you make of this? I mean, the United States are going to try and say that, you know, Russia and China are now the spoilers standing in the way of a ceasefire. What's your analysis?
Well, there's no analysis really, Michael. I mean, you've just superbly and professionally explained what's going on. People can see what the US ambassador to the UN said. What's concerning, I think, now is that the default of the United States on matters like this have bled from media and public relations to their own electorate to the geopolitical space more broadly. What do I mean by that? I mean that actually, rather than trying to offer anything substantive and concrete, the US offers wordplay and essentially nothing, while condemning China and Russia and being astonished they won't do something. And really, this is just for, you know, their domestic electorate. There's nothing really of substance happening here. So look, it's one thing to do that, you know, that kind of thing with your own domestic electorate. It's another thing to try and administer international relations like that, particularly when you're meant to be this global hyperpower. But America is no longer really a grown-up country. And we saw that particularly with the State of the Union address, the standout proposal by the Biden administration had actually been cooked up by Benjamin Netanyahu and Israel Katz, the Israeli Foreign Secretary. The United States on this issue has absolutely zero of substance to offer.
I think that point on this issue is an important one. I mean, not necessarily so much focusing on the United States, but on Russia, because of course, you know, it on the United Nations Security Council, it's not that, you know, the United States are the representatives of cynical badness in the world, and the Russians are these incredibly principled people. Obviously, they've been vetoing resolutions opposing their illegal invasion of Ukraine for a very long time. So this is superpower politics. But it is important to be aware when you're being hoodwinked, which essentially we are by the Americans at the moment. And I thought that, you know, that intervention by the US ambassador to the United Nations, which was so smug, you know, oh, these people are just being petty. They can't possibly vote for a motion that the United States has written. The United States motion was a smokescreen, right? It was just them trying to say to their domestic audience, as you say, Aaron, oh, we want a ceasefire while not really demanding one, which is exactly what the US have been doing this whole time, right? Saying, oh, we would like the Israelis to behave better, but we're not going to put any meaningful pressure on them because we're going to always give them a get-out clause. And this motion gave them a massive get-out clause. We would like a ceasefire so long as the hostages are released, as I explained. Hamas are not going to release the hostages for only a temporary ceasefire. Now, this is not a moral statement. This is not a statement about whether they should or shouldn't release the hostages. But you've got to talk, you know, in the real world. And I said this on Sky last night, actually. I think it's very important. Lots of people sort of say, well, you know, why should Israel stop bombing Gaza if Hamas don't release all of the hostages? And this is a really slippery, dangerous slope. Because the idea that in response to a hostage crisis, you get carte blanche to kill 30,000 people until those hostages are released and to keep killing people until those hostages are released. One, that's not sort of part of international law, but also that should be shocking. You know, there are lots of people in the world who have suddenly decided that if you've taken some hostages, or if some of your people have been taken hostages, then you can punish as many people, you can do as much, you know, shocking activity, you can kill as many people as possible until they're released. That's collective punishment. But people seem to, you know, the Americans, I mean, our government as well, seems to be accepting this idea that a genocidal war is a legitimate response to a hostage crisis. And it's not, right? There should be an unconditional ceasefire, regardless of what happens to the hostages. And then they can have a normal diplomatic process that countries have often entered into sort of throughout the 20th century when someone has been taken hostage. You have a diplomatic sort of discussion, right? Even when, you know, when there was a hostage crisis in Tehran, when sort of an Iranian group took the American diplomats hostage. I don't think it, I mean, maybe it was, but it shouldn't have been. I mean, it didn't happen. The Americans didn't say, okay, we're going to just bomb Iranians and kill 100 people a day until they're released, right? That didn't happen. If it did, if it was suggested, I hope people would have been shocked by it at the time. But now we seem to be saying this is a legitimate response to a hostage crisis. In terms of shocking actions by the Israelis, footage has been released by Al Jazeera. They say this is recovered from a downed Israeli drone. So it shows the moment four unarmed men are killed by the IDF in Khan Yunis. The four men are seen walking down a road before being hit by an Israeli airstrike. So two die instantly. One is able to walk further down the road before being killed by a second strike. And a last man you can see here stumbling away from the initial blast, sort of is trying to crawl away before he's struck. Aaron, I mean, that footage has been, you know, circulated around the world. Incredibly shocking. I mean, I think partly incredibly shocking because you're just seeing how faceless this is, right? You've got people who are walking down a pretty desolate space, and then you've got a drone up above. You know, they have no control over that. It's, you know, it's probably a first-person controlled drone, so there probably is a human controlling it somewhere, but it's so detached from humanity that you just got people being taken out by drones, sort of kind of like ants. You know, that's what it looks like. Obviously, this isn't anything new. This was, you know, the Americans have been doing this in the war on terror for a long time. Russia and Ukraine are both using drones of this type. But clearly, they didn't look like, you know, fighters at that point. We've got no idea what the history of these people are, but they didn't look like combatants at that point in time. It looked like four people walking in a direction being taken out by a drone from the sky. And we've now seen that all in HD. What's the significance of that?
Well, quickly, Michael, I don't think any comparison to Russia and Ukraine is fair here, because that is effectively a war. It's an illegal war prosecuted by the Russians, but it's a war between two nation states. Huge asymmetry. Russia has four times the population of Ukraine. But these are drones being used by two professional armies against one another. What you're seeing with this kind of attack is the application of force against civilian populations. And like you say, it's like ants. It's just shocking to see. What I would say is, 20 years ago, or in the last 20 years, there has been an increasing volume of these kinds of images, and they've been incredibly radicalizing for people. We've talked about Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo at the start of the war on terror, and how that radicalized millions of people across the global south in particular, and how we're now seeing infinitely worse images, more horrifying images than that, every single day coming out of Gaza. And we've asked on this show many times before, what are the long-term implications in terms of a cultural, political shift against Israel? I think there will be a huge one, by the way. I don't think it'll be a left-right thing. Today we've seen Tucker Carlson, Alex Jones, Candace Owens of the United States criticizing Israel, calling for an abrupt shift in US foreign policy in relation to Israel. I think that cannot be separated, that shift from the videos and images we've seen coming out of Gaza since October. But then when I saw those images, Michael, I was reminded of the video that was initially broken by WikiLeaks, if you remember. And this was US drones gunning down and killing people, blowing people up in Iraq. That horrified people. That really did horrify people. And I think more footage like this is just, it's the single biggest game changer in this entire conflict. And of course, most of it's being released through either social media or Al Jazeera. You know, we are seeing fundamentally a politics of some original reporting on the ground from the likes of CNN, BBC, some of it very commendable, I must say, but a lot of it is via press releases fundamentally from the Israelis or from, you know, Gaza, Palestinians, PLO, Hamas. But the most extraordinary stuff, the stuff that penetrates all of that, all the press releases, all the influences, it's just the raw footage of things like this. I have to say, I'm still shocked by some of the images I've seen of children, for instance, who are burned. And I've seen many, many, many right-wing people who are no friends of the Palestinians under normal circumstances say it's shocking and a ceasefire is absolutely critical. I think the public, by the way, is in a very different place on all of this to where the major parties are. And I think the same is true in the United States.
Yeah, no, I think that does seem to be the case. And I really echo, you know, I think people who've been on Twitter over the past few months and especially seeing, you know, the uncensored images of kids being killed or, you know, having full body burns, it's something you can't really forget. We're going to turn to the story, which is, you know, definitely going to dominate British news over the next few days. Kate Middleton has been diagnosed with the early stages of cancer and is receiving chemotherapy treatment. Her condition was discovered in January after she had abdominal surgery. That's what the Royals are reporting. So she has today released this statement recorded on Wednesday.
I wanted to take this opportunity to say thank you personally for all the wonderful messages of support and for your understanding whilst I've been recovering from surgery. It has been an incredibly tough couple of months for our entire family, but I've had a fantastic medical team who have taken great care of me, for which I'm so grateful. In January, I underwent major abdominal surgery in London, and at the time, it was thought that my condition was non-cancerous. The surgery was successful. However, tests after the operation found cancer had been present. My medical team therefore advised that I should undergo a course of preventative chemotherapy, and I'm now in the early stages of that treatment. This, of course, came as a huge shock. And William and I have been doing everything we can to process and manage this privately for the sake of our young family. As you can imagine, this has taken time. It has taken me time to recover from major surgery in order to start my treatment. But most importantly, it has taken us time to explain everything to George, Charlotte, and Louis in a way that's appropriate for them and to reassure them that I'm going to be okay. As I've said to them, I am well. And getting stronger every day by focusing on the things that will help me heal in my mind, body, and spirit. Having William by my side is a great source of comfort and reassurance too, as is the love, support, and kindness that has been shown by so many of you. It means so much to us both. We hope that you'll understand that as a family, we now need some time, space, and privacy while I complete my treatment. My work has always brought me a deep sense of joy, and I look forward to being back when I'm able. But for now, I must focus on making a full recovery. At this time, I'm also thinking of all those whose lives have been affected by cancer. For everyone facing this disease, in whatever form, please do not lose faith or hope. You are not alone.
I'm now joined by Navarra Media's royal correspondent, Ash Sarkar. Obviously, a reasonably young person finding out they've got cancer, very unpleasant. I mean, we've seen so much speculation about Kate Middleton and where she's been, on Twitter mainly, because, you know, the newspapers, the TV channels sort of quite careful with all this stuff. But on social media, we've seen loads. I hadn't seen any of them sort of suggest that she might have cancer. So this does seem to have sort of come out of the blue and to be a big surprise for everyone.
I mean, I don't think it's much of a surprise that social media obviously focused on the most salacious possibilities. So there were rumours swirling concerning domestic violence or that she had separated from Prince William. And what's interesting to me is that many of the newspapers reported on the existence of these rumours by framing it as a social media speculation story. So it gave the newspapers this buffer of plausible deniability by saying, well, we're not saying that these rumors have anything to them, but we're just reporting on their existence. And this is something which I said when the late Queen died, which is that the era of media deference towards the royal family as an institution is over. Sir Richard Colville used to be known as the Queen's anti-press secretary. He was known to Fleet Street as the abominable no man because he always said no to journalists. And look how far the royal family as an institution, not talking here about a human family, look how far they've been pushed in this handling of Kate Middleton's cancer diagnosis. It's completely understandable that a, you know, woman who is relatively young, is a mother to three young children, would not want to be in the public eye at this time, wouldn't want their condition being discussed. Now, rather than accepting the veil of silence that was being drawn around her by the communications wing of the British monarchy, instead, the press became, I think, a little bit more aggressive. So these rumours, and I've got to say, because I do not want to be sued by Buckingham Palace, that these rumours don't have any substantiation, but were reported in the American press of an affair between Prince William and another member of the British aristocracy. For years, there'd been a sort of complicit silence about the existence of these rumours from the British media. In the last few weeks, you started seeing articles pop up in different sections of the newspapers, like, you know, who is Rose Hanley? Who is the, I think it's the Marchioness of Cholmondeley or Marquess of Cholmondeley? I don't know. I don't really understand these titles. But basically, it was a bit of a manoeuvre on the part of the press to say, look, unless you give us the information that we're looking for, we're not going to play so nice when it comes to these other aspects of the royal family's PR operation. Now, this is miles and miles away from 1947, when absolutely glowing coverage of the then Princess Elizabeth and the Duke of Edinburgh, you know, latterly known as Prince Philip's honeymoon, this glowing coverage was seen as a gross intrusion of privacy. Now what we're seeing is that there is this kind of game being played between the media and the royal family, where strategically the media will, you know, play a bit more nasty in order to force further disclosure information from the royal family. Now, when it comes to matters of health, this is a really big step away from even what was going on just two generations ago. George VI, who was the late Queen's father, no one really knew what killed him until after he was already dead. When it came to the late Queen herself, there had been rumours, again, unsubstantiated, and I'm not saying there's anything in them, there had been rumours of a cancer diagnosis. The only person that I know to have made public reference to rumours as having something in them was Nicholas Witchell, who sort of blurted it out on BBC News shortly after the Queen passed away, and then he never ever spoke of it again. That's very different from the position that Kate Middleton has been forced into. So I know that many people in our audience will be going, why are you talking so much about this? Well, I think it matters because the media is going to be covering this, and this is already a different ball game from how the media has treated previous health crises in the royal family.
The interaction between like social media, the establishment press and the royal family has been very interesting over these past few months. I imagine what we're now going to see is sort of a bit of a moral panic, really, about sort of people discussing stuff on social media. I imagine, you know, before long, we'll have a lot of backbench MPs saying we need a law to make sure that people can't speculate about the royals on Twitter, and that this is probably going to be used as an excuse to try and clamp down on people making speculations on social media. I'm sure as well that Keir Starmer will get straight involved and say that he's up for that too.
someone is going to say that it's Meghan's fault. They're going to say Meghan stressed her out and she gave Kate Middleton cancer. I guarantee you someone is going to take that line, either a pundit or a newspaper. Watch this space.
Yeah, it'll be 48 hours. GB News will probably do it tomorrow. But yeah, we won't be covering this story as much as I'm sure the rest of the press will. It will be wall to wall. But we, you know, we do keep abreast of these kind of things. Let's go straight on to our next story. The eyes of the world are on the humanitarian catastrophe unfolding in Gaza as a result of Israel's attacks on the enclave. But there's another crisis taking place, one the UN has described as, quote, a humanitarian travesty. It isn't getting much attention at all. This is Edom Wasornu, Director of Operations at the UN Office for the Coordination for Humanitarian Affairs.
Sudan is on the course to become the world's possibly worst hunger crisis. Already 18 million people, again, has been said, more than one third of the country's estimated population are facing food insecurity. By the time the lean season arrives in May, people in some parts of Darfur could face what we term IPC phase 5 level acute food insecurity. We call this stage a catastrophe.
Wasornu added that an estimated 222,000 children in Sudan could die from malnutrition, and that the WHO report that 70% of health facilities are currently not functioning. Now, this catastrophic situation in Sudan stems from the civil war, which erupted there last April when two powerful generals began a struggle for control of the country. The first of those is Abdel Fattah al-Burhan. He's the head of the Sudanese army. He became Sudan's de facto president in 2019 after ousting the previous president in a coup. The other figure is Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, who was Burhan's second in command and also participated in the 2019 coup. Dagalo is more commonly known by the nickname Hemeti. He is the head of the Rapid Support Forces, or RSF. They're a largely Arab paramilitary force which grew out of the Janjaweed. And now the Janjaweed were a militant group responsible for the killing of hundreds of thousands of black Africans in Darfur between 2003 and 2020. At the time, that violence was called the first genocide of the 21st century. And now Burhan's and Hemedi's struggle for power over the last 10 months has killed at least 15,000, left 33,000 injured and displaced 10 million people within Sudan. The fighting between these competing military groupings initially focused on the capital Khartoum, but it has now spread throughout the country. However, the most extreme violence appears to be taking place once again in Darfur. Located in the country's west, Darfur is a mineral-rich region, roughly the same size as Spain. Home to around 80 ethnic groups, it has a population of over 9 million people. Growing violence in the region has now resulted in the displacement of 3 million Darfuris, a third of the population, with many gathering in makeshift camps on the country's border with Chad. And the political vacuum in Khartoum has meant that what little aid there is not being distributed. According to Médecins Sans Frontières, in just one camp in northern Darfur, 13 children are dying every day of malnutrition and unsafe drinking water. 700,000 people have also crossed the border into Chad, living in temporary camps near the Sudanese border. That has created its own problems. Chad is one of the world's poorest countries, and the Norwegian Refugee Council says that those taking refuge there lack the most basic resources for survival. To cope with the crisis in Chad, the UN's refugee agency says it needs $320 million this year. So far, it's received only $12 million. That's just 4% of the total. For those remaining in Sudan, the violence continues to be brutal, with aid agencies sounding the alarm over the possibility of a second genocide in Darfur. The UN Joint Human Rights Office has recently received, quote, credible reports of 13 mass graves in western Darfur, and the agency has accused both the RSF and the Sudanese army of sexual violence and harassment of women. The BBC reported this testimony from one of those women.
Yesterday, 19-year-old Amina found out that she is pregnant. Within minutes, she will begin an abortion desperately hoping that her family never knows.
It happened in Sudan. I'm not married and I was a virgin, except for the incident that happened.
This young woman, whose name we have changed, was trying to flee fighting in her hometown when she was captured, held for a day, and repeatedly raped.
I didn't tell anyone, and I don't think anyone knows.
The UN says the sexual violence experienced by women like Amina is a defining characteristic of the conflict in Sudan and has been used as a weapon of war.
In December, US Secretary of State Antony Blinken said that the RSF were responsible for crimes against humanity and ethnic cleansing in Darfur, and he accused both the RSF and the Sudanese army of committing war crimes. In January, ICC prosecutor Karim Khan said that both the RSF and the Sudanese authorities were blocking his ability to investigate potentially criminal abuses in Darfur. Earlier today, I spoke to Joshua Craze, a researcher and writer specializing in the politics of Sudan. I began by asking him whether the civil war in Sudan had become an ethnic conflict.
Whether it's become an ethnic conflict is a difficult question, because the conflict in Sudan is a patchwork of different dynamics. So the RSF, the Rapid Support Forces under Hemeti, have been mobilizing in Darfur since 2022 on the basis of a certain form of Arab nationalism that really has its roots in a conference that Gaddafi held way back in the 80s in Libya. And the war has been a chance, especially in West Darfur, for many of those Arab groups to pursue what are effectively local ethnicized conflicts that have been supercharged effectively by the national conflict. So that is an example of a clearly ethnic relationship within the war. There's another example of that in South Kordofan, which is in the south of Sudan, not South Sudan, but the south of Sudan. And there, a lot of the Arab groups have joined the RSF partly to wage a war against the Nuba. And the Nuba, again, are a non-Arab population that form part of one of the rebel groups that fought against Khartoum for 22 years during Sudan's long second civil war. So around the country, if I want to say in brief, there's been this way that the overall logic of the civil war has been taken up to fight local conflicts. And those groups have been armed, in the case of the Arab groups, by the RSF. And you've also had anti-Darfuri Arab attacks in places like Port Sudan, which is now the de facto capital of the country, owned or controlled by SAF, the Sudan Armed Forces. But I wouldn't say that the actual logic of the conflict is ethnic.
Once order breaks down, once you've got a generalized war, then you will get these sort of ethnic conflicts coming up, of course, sort of in Darfur, where the most attention is focused internationally at the moment. I've been sort of following this to some degree for a year now. And it's still, you know, it's not completely clear in my mind what the two different sides are standing for. So you've got the RSF, which is this militia, and then you've got the SAF, which is the official armed forces. This has now descended into a complete civil war. Is this just a sort of battle now between warlords for control, or is there something deeper going on here?
I think there's something much deeper going on here, which I think is the breakdown of the political economic relationship that formed the Sudanese state. And let me state that really simply. If Sudan, since independence 56, has been about a racist center extracting resources from the peripheries of the country with their myriad ethnic groups, relying on them for surplus labor, while maintaining all the political power in the center, I think that relationship itself is unthinkable after this war. Because whatever one says about Hemeti and the RSF, they are a force from the periphery that are now contesting a war in the center of the country. Why are they contesting the war? Well, I think if you take the RSF, it's three different things at once. It's like an incredible Schrodinger's cat. And the fact that it's these three different things at once prevents it being any of them well, except that you need to be all these three different things in order to survive. So what are those three things? One, in Darfur, it is an ethnically organized Arab militia. It's drawing in Arab fighters from Chad. It's waging war against non-Arab groups who are often agriculturalist, waging a transhuman or a pastoralist agenda and trying to gain control of Darfur. Very much a local ethnic conflict, you know, prefigured by climatic change in Chad and Darfur. Two, though, is also a transnational corporation which has sent mercenaries to Libya, to Yemen, which is basically doing the bidding of the United Arab Emirates at a regional level. It's trying to guarantee them access to the Red Sea. It's trying to guarantee them agricultural land. The Emirates has bought off Chad, so it will support the RSF. It's about to buy off South Sudan, so it will support the RSF. At the same time, Hemeti is also trying to position himself as a statesman who will bring forth a sort of a new civilian government, of course, with this infrastructure, which is RSF-controlled military. So he's trying to do three things, and they're all undercutting each other. So he keeps on getting involved in massacres in Darfur, which don't make him look like a statesman.
One thing you hear about Sudan, it's a conflict that not many people know much about, is you hear people say people should be talking more about this. You know, the level of suffering seems to be, you know, comparable to what's going on in Gaza. But we talk about Gaza a lot because, you know, I mean, personally, I feel like I understand the conflict. I also understand, you know, what the right thing to do would be. I think if the West put some pressure on Israel to stop bombing Gaza and come to an agreement about a two-state solution, you could have a solution, right? I can see how this works. Whereas when I look at Sudan, I'm not sure what I would be demanding, you know, and I imagine lots of people are the same. So when people say, you know, we should be talking more about Sudan, we need to do something about Sudan, I mean, what can that mean in practice? How should people understand this?
You don't see, as you say, the same like simple narrative, which is not to say it's a wrong narrative, about Sudan. I think, on the other hand, just to appreciate the depths of the tragedy and the struggle within the country, right, in which you have literally half the population in need of humanitarian assistance. You have more than 18 million people facing acute food insecurity, right? We're talking about 5 million people slipping into IPC5, which is the categorization, which is famine, right? 5 million people slipping into famine in the coming months. And there are actually people who are around the country organizing themselves to try to address that. And that's the resistance committees. And I think, if you remember, when the war began in April 2023, the humanitarian agencies largely hightailed out of there, understandably, to some degree. But the people, especially in Khartoum, who picked up the slack, were the groups that had run the protests that had led to the fall of Bashir. And as the war began, there was a lot of debate around whether these groups should be backed by humanitarians, and a lot of pushback from humanitarians that said, oh no, these groups are political. We can't back these groups, which is absurd. Because, of course, at the moment, to get aid through Port Sudan, you need the sign-off of the Sudan Armed Forces, the HAC, the Humanitarian Oversight Committee. How is that not political? Of course that's political. So I think the second thing to say is, like, there is a very clear narrative here that there are groups throughout this country, civilian groups, organizing to try to create new spaces for dialogue and try to create humanitarian routes for people. And they're being systematically marginalized by Western diplomatic powers, who have placed all of their emphasis on using Sudan effectively as a scapegoat to try to restore relationships between the US and Saudi following October 7th. Sorry, it's a British audience.
In a civil war, I suppose often for the general population of a public, what you want is either for one side to win quickly or for them to come to some kind of peace agreement, for there to be some peace process. Are either of those two sort of options on the horizon, and how would one hasten one of those options if that were what someone was desiring?
So there aren't two sides to the conflict. That's important to say, right? There's a whole bunch of non-aligned rebel groups. There's the Sudan People's Liberation Army North, which controls liberated territory in South Kordofan and Blue Nile. There's a variety of groups in Darfur resisting both the RSF and the army. So it's not, obviously, that's not giving you a simple answer. That's saying that there's a lot of different groups. I think, what can the West do? For a start, it can make as a de facto red line that the resistance committees and the emergency rooms currently giving out aid and defecting and assisting the people of South Sudan are a necessary and fundamental part of any negotiations. I think at the moment there is, because of course there isn't the West, right? There's a series of different competing actors, each with their own interests, and there's a great deal of forum shopping. I think one of the problems with these sort of negotiations, as ever, is that the demand to do something, anything, often takes the place of actually substantive commitments. And so what you get is basically just PR and empty talk. And since the beginning of the war, we've seen talks all over the place. We've seen them in Addis, we've seen them in Riyadh, we've seen them in Qatar. It doesn't, you know, like name the place, there's been talks. But the reality is there hasn't been the ground for those talks. And what those talks have done is reified the position of the military actors, has made the military actors the fundamental organizing principle of Sudan. Whereas the reality was before this conflict, the military was weak. And what this conflict has done, even though the people of Sudan are losing, is make both sides win because of the consequence of the negotiations, which haven't put the people of Sudan first. Instead, it's marginalized them in face of the military actors. And of course, there has to be a negotiated solution to this, and there will be. Neither side can win this militarily. But the question is in how that solution is arrived at, what those negotiations look like, the details and the specifics, and what the West should be pushed for, if we're allowed to use that absurd abstraction for a moment, is an absolute unconditional civilian handover to the resistance committees and the emergency rooms. Because what we've seen is America look desperately around for any sort of third force. They love third forces that can possibly like take a place and like guarantee a civilian transition. But all of those forces have joined up with the RSF, right? Abdullah Hamdok, the great technocrat, you know, former World Bank employee, is now to be seen promenading around against a man indubitably guilty of committing war crimes.
We can go straight on to our next story. Work and Pension Secretary Mal Stride has caused controversy with comments on mental health. In an interview with The Telegraph, he said that mental health culture has gone too far. He was giving an interview about proposals to get more people back into work. So in that interview, he also said this: "While I'm grateful for today's much more open approach to mental health, there is a danger that this has gone too far. There is a real risk now that we are labelling the normal ups and downs of human life as medical conditions, which then actually serve to hold people back and ultimately drive up the benefit bill." He also complained about the supposed ease of getting a sick note from a GP. So he said, if they go to the doctor and say, "I'm feeling rather down and bluesy," the doctor will give them on average about 7 minutes, and then on 94% of occasions, they will be signed off as not fit to carry out any work whatsoever. You have to wonder, why might the GP only have 7 minutes to see you? Might it be because they're a little bit overworked? And Mel Stride is responding to statistics which show the number of people who are out of work because of long-term sickness has increased dramatically in the last 5 years. So this is data from the ONS, which shows the top 10 types of health conditions are people aged 16 to 64 who are economically inactive because of long-term sickness. And it shows you the numbers in 2019 and the numbers in 2023. And as you can see, they've gone up by a lot. So in 2019, there were just under 1 million people who were off work with depression, bad nerves, or anxiety. That's now gone up to nearly 1.4 million, so a significant increase in just 4 years. And then for all of these conditions, you can see that the numbers have gone up: problems with legs or feet, problems with back or neck, and then you've got a generic category of mental illness. So you can see there are lots more people out of work because of long-term sickness than there were just 4 years ago. Of course, we did have a pandemic in that time. And interestingly, or I mean, you could say worryingly, the rise is being driven potentially, or very much so, in part by young people. So this chart here, which put together by the Resolution Foundation, shows the share of the population who are economically inactive due to ill health. And you've got two lines here. So one is showing you 1998 and one is showing you 2022. This is really interesting because it used to be the case in 1998 that there was a really steep curve as people got older. So when you were 20, it was very unlikely you'd be off on long-term sickness. So you can see it looks like about 1 or 2% of people. But by the time you get to 60, it's quite, well, not likely, but there's a big chance you'll be off work with sickness. So you've got nearly 20% of people. That's in 1998. Once you get to 2022, you've got a much flatter curve. So whereas before you'd have 1% of people who are 20 on long-term sickness, now you've got around 6%. So you're seeing that you've got a lot more people who are young who are on long-term sickness than used to be. So that is potentially worrying. Whether or not Mel Stride's diagnosis is correct is a different one. And on BBC Question Time this week, author Philippa Gregory responded to those statements from Mel Stride.
What was really worrying to me about the statement from the Minister for Work and Pensions today was a suggestion that there was some sort of weak-spirited malingering going on, which is, you know, he was saying that young people were self-diagnosing with mental health issues.
Not just young people, people generally.
He specialised, his concentration was that there was this new sort of spirit of young people failing to get it, feeling bluesy. Was a word.
Well, he said was an increase. There's been an increase in conversations on mental health, which has led to people effectively self-diagnosing conditions. I'm grateful for today's much more open approach to mental health, he said, but there's a danger this has gone too far.
The reason people are self-diagnosing is because they can't get an appointment with a doctor. And worse than that, I think this is absolutely part of what we've seen happen before when Ian Duncan Smith retired from the Conservatives because they were trying to limit benefits to people with disability. And what we've got now is, I think, the suggestion that people who are mentally unwell are, in fact, not really that mentally unwell and that they should be out at work. And clearly, I mean, he talks about people having 7 minutes with a doctor and getting a sick note and that giving them a guaranteed pension for life. This is madness. He needs to go into a job centre and talk to the people who spend their lives trying to get people into work, trying to get reasonable adjustments for people who are unwell and trying to help people who desperately want to work, who desperately want a healthy life, who desperately want a future and some way of earning money, but are literally too unwell at the moment to do so. And we said when we went through COVID, we all said to each other in the spirit of post-COVID sympathy, there is going to be a lot of trouble with people who have spent so long in isolation and whose links with their community and their work have broken down. We're going to find it very hard with young people who haven't gone through the usual education process, with the kids who didn't do nursery, with the socialisation of the very, very young, with the apprentices who couldn't get in and have a mentor that they met every day and talked to. And we knew there would be this problem. Now there is this problem. And what we're saying is that it's not a problem at all.
You can see that answer was very much resonating, or that intervention was very much resonating with the audience. Aaron, where do you stand on this? I mean, it's clear that there are a lot more people who are off work sick, especially with mental health problems. It's clear that is affecting young people much more than it did in the recent past. What's your analysis of what's going on, and what do you think of Mel Stride's analysis of what's going on?
So the two graphs you showed, Mike, were really useful. The one in terms of breaking down who's out of work long-term by age, it's very important to say, even though amongst, you know, people in there, basically after your mid-20s, 25 to 30, it's broadly the same as 1998. Let's be honest, the difference is, you know, 1.5%. But clearly something has shifted with people in their early 20s, people entering the labour market straight out of university. Something has happened. That's inarguable. It's still very low, but something has happened. I personally think that has something to do with young people's relationship to technology, particularly mobile phones, to the housing market, to the labour market. I think if you've lived through a pandemic, as a teenager, it's going to probably have had some impact on your mental health. I think that's inarguable. And I think what's really interesting for me, Michael, is the fact that older people who are long-term out of work is significantly lower than it was in the late 1990s. I would argue that's a direct consequence of the fact that we've reduced elderly poverty, particularly pensioner poverty. Of course, we're talking about people who aren't yet of pensionable age, but older people, generally less likely to be in poverty than they were 25 years ago. They tend to enjoy housing security. They've got a pretty good deal in terms of housing asset prices being very healthy over the last 20 years. And of course, they're far more likely to be on the housing market. I say this stat, own property rather. I say this stat repeatedly, Michael, it's huge. The number of people in their late 30s, early 40s who rent has tripled in the last 20 years. And I think the issue of housing security is so, so big. When we're talking about the mental health of people below 30, this is not about a few hard knocks and not being able to dust yourself off. I say this as somebody who's had depression and anxiety in the past, The reason why I had depression and anxiety is because when I lived in London, I had to move 15 times in 15 years. That broke me. That was not an experience that either my mum or my dad had any comprehension of, and they hadn't really themselves lived in particularly august surroundings. They weren't especially well off. My dad's now a taxi driver. My mum had various jobs. She was a cleaning lady at one point, but they generally enjoyed housing security. The idea for them that it was normal to move every single year, 15 years, was just outlandish. And that's now a very common experience. I'm not going to say for the majority of young people, it might be, but it's certainly a very common experience for a massive minority of young people. And so I think if you look at that profound shift in people's relationship to housing and housing security, say under the age of 35, with what we presume to be, you know, reasonable expectations 25, 35 years ago, I think that explains a hell of a lot on mental health. Anxiety, depression are very real conditions. Personally, when I had that, it knocked me out. It took way more out of me than physical health conditions have done in the past. It's inexplicable, Michael. When you have intense depression, it is impossible to work. When you have anxiety, it is impossible to plan for the future, to do the basics. You know, as somebody who's had depression in the past, I now isolate somebody when I think they may be getting the first signs of depression. They have very low resilience. The slightest thing upsets them. They can't do very basic things. They can't, you know, send an email. They can't send an invoice. Those are the first warning signs. So this is a serious issue. It's happening. It's real. But this explanation of, well, they're just not as tough as people used to be. Give them the housing security people used to have, and then let's see. That would be the experiment I would want to run.
You've made an association there between sort of good mental health and economic security. And I suppose an association, you know, that goes in the opposite direction. You're more likely to get mental health problems if you haven't got economic security. Someone who disagrees was on the panel on Question Time, Rod Liddell. You might have heard of him. He hasn't got the nicest of histories. He said this about mental health.
We do have a problem in this country with mental health. It's not particularly something associated with poverty. It's something associated with enemy and alienation, and we've become a far, far less communal country over
the last 50, 60 years. A few years ago, Rod, was not quite that. You said, we're in a perpetual tizzy about our nation's mental health, largely as a consequence, I suspect, of us all being too affluent and comfortable, not having enough other stuff to worry about.
Okay, if you want me to address that rather than the question, I'll do that.
Well, no, it's obviously, it's just you saying you think it's the issues about anime and other matters.
Well, I'm
just saying
it's about anime.
This was just another.
Yeah, I do think it's about anime. Well, do you know what country has the worst mental health in the world? Monaco, the richest country in the world. And if you go down the list, you will see that the countries with the worst mental health, i.e. the most referrals, the most therapists, the most psychiatrists who are people who see psychiatrists per capita, Monaco, Netherlands, Norway, Belgium, we're in the list as well, but a bit further down. So it's affluence. So there is a link between affluence and the kind of introspection which comes about as a consequence.
There might be a sliver of insight in what he said there. I don't want to completely deny that. But the statistics he used were nonsense, right? To say that Norway has the worst mental health in the world because they have the most therapists, you know, because they have the most people being treated for depression, is just so stupid. That is such bad statistics, right? The fact that they have more therapists, the fact that they have more people being treated for depression probably has a lot more to do with the fact that they have they can afford it, right? They can afford the kind of healthcare that provides those services. And actually, if you look at a more, I suppose, reasonable statistics or a reasonable way of measuring people's happiness, Norway actually tends to be one of the happiest, right? So often you get these surveys where they ask people about life satisfaction. How satisfied are you with your life? And it is those Nordic countries that come top and the countries that come bottom. I mean, at the moment, I think it's Afghanistan and Lebanon. So if you've got a country that has civil strife, that has civil war, or severe poverty, then people tend to not be so satisfied with their lives. Now, it's not a one-to-one ratio. So you will get some very poor countries where you've got good social cohesion, you've got a sort of peaceful environment, you might have relative sort of equality and then you might have sort of decent life satisfaction. But in general, there is a correlation between wealth and life satisfaction. And the idea that you measure, you know, the country with the best mental health is the country with the least therapists, is the country with the least people on antidepressants, is one of the most stupid things I've ever heard sort of spoken from the Question Time platform. And there's good competition, right? There were also some people in the audience who weren't impressed by Liddell's point.
I'm a medical student, we all are. And we see day in, day out, people who have a really rubbish situation at the moment because they can't afford food for their kids to put on the table. They've not got a job because there isn't the jobs up here because the Tory government haven't invested money up here. It's ridiculous that you think poverty has nothing to do with mental health.
It isn't. It isn't. If you look at the figures, it's nothing to do with it at all.
I see people day in, day out who struggle with their mental health.
It just doesn't correlate. You know, some of the poorest countries in the world have some of the highest levels of social solidity and social togetherness and the lowest mental health problems. It's sorry.
Again, the way he sort of feigns, sorry, you know, I'm the guy with the statistics. You might have your anecdotes as a medical student, but I have looked at the statistics and it is the Norwegians who take the most antidepressants and therefore they are the people with the worst mental health in the world. Now, he's using a completely, completely ridiculous data point. And then he sort of has this smugness to say, I'm the social scientist here. Now, I actually really like social science. I actually do think it is important to look at data as well as anecdote. And I think that often anecdotes do get it wrong. And if you look at the data, you might have a different perspective. But he is working from a knowledge base, which is just not very good. That medical student wasn't the only health professional in the audience.
I'm a therapist. I work in a school. So I know what I'm talking about. Rod, if you think this is nothing to do with poverty, can I suggest that you live in poverty for 6 months and I will give you a free psychotherapy session and we'll chat about your mental health. It's absolutely everything.
I'm sorry, but it's not about poverty. Here's the thing. As our country has got more affluent, we have 40-fold more therapists and psychiatrists than we had in the 50s. And I think it's something like 8 times as many as we had.
And the population is much larger.
Sorry, just let me finish. And 8 times as many as we had in the 1990s into 2000. You know, many, many more. It's been a huge growth industry.
It's been a huge growth industry. It's completely, completely bizarre. You know, all other growth industries, probably people who teach people how to sing. That's not because we've become worse singers who need more corrections. Right? Because we are a wealthier society which can afford these kind of things. There are more referees. That means that people must do more fouls and we must become more aggressive people. No more people are playing football. Right? It's stupid. You sort of get that smugness of you might have frontline knowledge. You might be a doctor. You might be a healthcare professional. But I've looked at the stats and we've increased the number of therapists we have as we've got richer. And therefore, I can deduce that as we've got richer, we've also got sadder. Stupid. Let's go to our final story. It's a silly one. You can relax for this one. Don't mess with our flag. That's the message from seemingly lots of people in England after Nike released our great nation's new football kit. So Nike called this marking on the back of the new England collar. They said it was a playful update to the flag of St. George, which they said appears on the collar to unite and inspire. So as you can see, it's a modification of the St. George's flag. The horizontal line has been changed from red to shades of purple and blue. Now, I can see how to Nike that update might have seemed playful, but for many Brits, this wasn't all fun and games, and it certainly didn't unite and inspire. Outrage has been unleashed online and in the papers. And on Thursday night, Keir Starmer got involved.
Was it wrong for Nike to change the cross of St. George on the back of the New England kit?
Yeah, I think it was. And I think
it's
hard.
What was it they were doing?
Look, I mean, as you know, I'm a big football fan. I go to England games, men, women's game, and the flag is used by everybody. It is a unified, it doesn't need to be changed. We just need to be proud of it. So I think they should just reconsider this and change it back.
All right.
I'm not even sure they can properly explain why they thought they needed to change in the first place.
Now, if you thought he was feigning outrage, have a look at Emily Thornberry on GB News.
I think it's all very odd. I mean, if you look at it, what have Nike done? I mean, seriously, you can hardly recognise it as the England flag, can you? I mean, England flag is a simple white background and a red cross. Seems to me, why can't they just leave it alone? Imagine how cross the French would get if they started putting bits of purple on the tricolour. Or they changed the Welsh flag, took away the dragon and stuck a pussycat on instead. I mean, people would be up in arms. You know, I think he's right. I think, why can't we just have us just a straight England flag on the back of these shirts?
Yeah, but to be fair, you're not a particular fan of the St. George's Cross, are you?
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, you took the mickey out of someone flying the England flag and had to resign as a result of it.
Oh, you're talking about a photo I took 10 years ago.
Yes.
And I put on Twitter. Yeah, no, I took a photo 10 years ago of a house that was completely covered in England flags. Is that what you mean?
Yeah.
And people made all sorts of assumptions about it. All right, okay. Sorry, I'm so far beyond, like, kind of trying to sort of explain, you know, it was a photograph, you know, and other people have decided what it was that I was thinking or saying. You know, I mean, as I say, it was a very long time ago. But I did, you know, as far as I was concerned, if it was going to do any damage to the Labour Party. Do you know what I did? I resigned. Do you remember when people used to do that when they made a mistake? We haven't seen that forever, I think, from this lot. You know, they don't do resigning, do they?
Now, if that was her sober in the morning, I'd love to see Emily Formby drunk. She's got a lot of a vim, even if her politics are all over the place. Labour, you know, one thing you can give them. This is one of the few times they were ahead of the Tories. So Labour were already outraged at these new shirts on Thursday night. That's when Keir Starmer was speaking. It took the Tories until 9:30 on Friday morning to come out against the kit. So Lucy Fraser is the culture secretary. She said this, "Fans should always come first. And it's clear that this is not what fans want. Our national heritage, including the St. George's Cross, brings us together. Toying with it is pointless and unnecessary." And not wanting to miss out, Rishi Sunak has been speaking to TV cameras.
"Obviously, I prefer the original, and my general view is that when it comes to our national flags, we shouldn't mess with them because they're a source of pride, identity, who we are, and they're perfect as they are."
They're perfect as they are. It's got kind of like Mother's Day card vibe to it when Rishi Sunak speaks about these things. I love the way he is a football. Of course, all of these people are massive football fans. It's not at all put on for the cameras. The FA, though, have said this afternoon they have no intention of recalling the kit. They're not listening to Sunak or Starmer or Formby. In any case, we have perhaps got a bit more sensitive about changing the colours of flags than we used to be. So for the 2012 Olympics, Team GB got Stella McCartney to design their kit. And this was the result. So it's a Union Jack, which was made white with various shades of blue. So they've clearly changed the colour of that flag. There were some sort of bits of red included, but that's definitely a modification. Aaron, have we got a bit more sensitive than we used to be? This has caused a lot of outrage. 10 years ago, or 12 years ago, I suppose now, we had I quite like that Stella McCartney kit. I quite like this thing on the back of the new football kit, but no one else seems to.
Well, that's you in the bad books of GB News, Michael. I accept the argument that if this happened in any other country, the reaction would have been the same. And I actually personally can't think of a single example of this happening with the Brazil kit, the Italy kit, the France kit, the Spain kit. I cannot think of this happening. I have to be honest. So that's the first point. Secondly, I don't really care. Third point, the thing I care about more than anything we've mentioned is the fact that a child's football kit for England is £65, a child's kit. That to me, you know, if it was half the price and they kept the flag, I mean, I take that. If you're talking about what matters to you and the various costs and whatnot. But I can understand why people are upset about it, Michael, because like I said, there is really no comparison that I can think of in modern football kits. I'm sure some clever cogs will pop one out in the comments, but I certainly can't think of one. You obviously had the Olympic kit, like you said, in 2012, although that did anger some people. It certainly didn't elicit this kind of reaction. You know, wholesale condemnation from both political parties. What I found really remarkable, Michael, is yesterday we had the news that child poverty is just extraordinary levels. I think the highest level in 30 years. And we had less of a response from both major political parties on that because they were focusing on the colours chosen by Nike for the England football kit. I think that says quite a lot. So to be brief, I understand why somebody would be upset. I personally don't find it that big a deal. And the real affront to me is the cost of these kits for young kids. Because if you're saying this is something which should belong to everyone, I agree. You know, I grew up watching the England national team. One of the first football matches I remember is England losing to the Netherlands in a World Cup 94 qualifier, where Graham Taylor famously said, "I do not like orange." The point is, though, I think what's of significance to young kids who want to feel part of something bigger is being able to buy the kit in the first place. So I would like us to be talking about that instead, but I get it. Those aren't the colours of St. George.
I was just looking up, the French football kit doesn't have a flag on it. It's just that royal blue colour. So sort of the idea that sort of every... I'm not even sure there normally is. I suppose there is normally that cross on the back of it, but it's not, you know, it's not like changing a flag on a thing. It's a little addendum to a kit. So I'm intensely relaxed about it, but I'm also intensely relaxed if they change it. Aaron, thank you for joining me this evening.
The Italian shield is an Italian tricolor. Nobody would mess with that. The Italians would go crazy. Michael, thank you. Have a good weekend.
That's on the front of the kit, though. This is just on the back, on the neck. Anyway, it's always good to end on a low-stakes story. Thanks to all of you for tuning in. Make sure to come back on Monday at 6 p.m. Have a great weekend. You've been watching Navarra Media. Good night.
This broadcast is brought to you by Navarra Media. Go to navarramedia.com/support.